Imagine standing on like a single piece of jagged rock where a 4th century Greek priest, a 14th century Crusader knight, and maybe a modern day yacht captain have all tried to claim the exact same spot.
Yeah, it's quite an image.
Right. And you aren't in a museum looking at artifacts behind a velvet rope. You are 50 kilometers south of Rhodestown on the East Coast, and you are literally walking on top of millennia of contested history.
Which is just incredible to think about.
It really is. Today we're taking you on a deep dive into Lindos, and we're tossing out the standard travel guides for this one because our goal isn't just to give you a pleasant itinerary.
No, definitely not.
We want to deconstruct the mechanics of this place. We're exploring how this crazy collision of ancient Greek engineering, maritime economics, and just brutal natural geography forged one of the most resilient settlements in the Aegean.
It's a fascinating machine when you break it down.
Okay, let's unpack this, because to truly understand the sheer audacity of Lindos, you have to crane your neck upward. You're standing at sea level, and hovering over you, capping a sheer limestone cliff the height of a 30-story skyscraper, is a massive fortress.
It is a profound manipulation of natural geography. When you look up at that 116-meter vertical drop, you aren't just looking at a geological
Oh,
anomaly.
that is very intentional.
Exactly. You're looking at a masterclass in military and spiritual dominance. What's fascinating here is the absolute density of the history crammed onto that single limestone plateau.
Just layer upon layer.
Right. You have foundational layers up there that predate classical antiquity. And built directly upon those rough foundations is the incredibly precise geometry of a Doric temple dedicated to Athena Lyndia.
Which was what, 4th century BC?
Heavily reconstructed in the 4th century BC, yeah.
Yeah.
But history doesn't stop there. Fast forward to the medieval period, and the Knights of St. John, the Crusader order known as the Hospitallers, they take control of Rhodes. They looked at that ancient Greek sanctuary, recognized its flawless tactical positioning, and just wrapped the entire upper plateau in massive, unyielding medieval fortification walls.
I actually have to stop you there and push back on the logistics of this because I was looking at the topography in our sources and, well, I was trying to do the math.
Okay, what did you find?
The climb up from the village takes about 20 minutes of intense, sustained ascending on a stepped path, dragging thousands of tons of quarried limestone 116 meters up a sheer cliff face without modern machinery.
Yeah, it's a massive undertaking.
It sounds like a logistical nightmare that would completely bankrupt a local economy. Was the strategic advantage of that specific rock really worth crippling their resources instead of just building a formidable sea-level fortress?
It was absolutely worth it. Because, well, the alternative was annihilation.
Wait, really? Annihilation?
Yeah, you have to look at the geopolitical reality of the Eastern Mediterranean. The Aegean Sea wasn't just a body of water. It was the ancient and medieval superhighway for grain, spices, timber, and warfare.
So it's a major choke point.
Precisely. Rhodes geographically chokes off the naval route between the Aegean and the Levant. If you control Lindos, you have a massive line of sight over those shipping lanes.
That makes sense.
A sea-level fortress can be besieged by naval bombardment or overwhelmed by a huge landing force. But when you elevate your defenses by 30 stories, you completely neutralize the siege engines of the era.
Because they just can't aim that high.
Right. A 14th-century trebuchet or an early cannon situated on a rolling ship deck cannot effectively breach walls towering that high. The knights weren't just building a wall, they were engineering a physical deterrent against the Mamluks and the expanding Ottoman Empire.
Wow.
The elevation made the Acropolis functionally impregnable.
So the ancient Greeks built for the gods, and the knights built for ballistics.
That is a great way to put it.
They effectively hijacked a sacred site to create a medieval missile silo. That completely changes how you view those walls.
Yeah.
But, you know, a military choke point in the sky is useless without an economy to sustain it.
For sure. The fortress protects the wealth, and the wealth lives at the bottom of the cliff.
Exactly. When you descend from that sun-baked limestone plateau, you drop straight into the village of Lindos, which is this incredibly dense, almost claustrophobic labyrinth of narrow cobblestone lanes.
The spatial contraction is severe. I mean, you go from the infinite horizon of the Acropolis to alleyways
Yeah.
so narrow you can practically touch the whitewashed walls on both sides.
Yeah, and those pathways aren't just quaint, right? Their layout is highly intentional.
Very much so. The labyrinthine design serves a dual purpose. First, it breaks up the harsh Aegean winds that whip off the sea.
Which is crucial in the winter.
Right. And historically, it functioned as a secondary defense mechanism.
Yeah.
If pirates ever breached the shore, navigating that confusing, chaotic grid of dead ends and tight corners while under fire from the roofs,
that would be a tactical nightmare.
Absolute nightmare.
And it can physically feel that history under your boots. The cobblestones are grooved by centuries of donkey carts and human foot traffic.
Yeah, you see those smooth depressions in the stone where people have pivoted around the same corner for hundreds of years.
It's wild. And right in the middle of this maze, you stumble upon the Church of the Panagia from the 14th century, containing these vivid, largely intact Byzantine frescoes.
They're stunning.
They are. But the architectural element that kept jumping out in the research wasn't the church. It was the domestic infrastructure, the captain's houses.
Ah, yes. The captain's houses, built primarily between the 16th and 18th centuries, they really are the socioeconomic heartbeat of Lindos.
Because they represent the merchant class.
Exactly. While the knights controlled the military high ground, the local sea captains controlled the wealth. These houses feature high exterior walls for privacy and protection, opening up into these beautiful interior courtyards.
And the defining feature of those courtyards is the holakia, right?
The holakia, yes.
Yeah.
The traditional black and white pebble mosaics.
I really want to dig into those mosaics because it's incredibly easy for a visitor to glance down at these intricate geometric patterns or maritime symbols and just assume they're like decorative outdoor carpets.
Sure, just pretty floors.
Right. But placing thousands of smooth little stones into the dirt seems incredibly tedious. Where did this specific architectural quirk even come from?
It stems from a brilliant intersection of maritime practicality and environmental engineering. First, consider the materials.
Okay.
The black volcanic stones and white limestone pebbles were often collected from nearby beaches, but many were actually brought back as ballast in the hulls of empty trading ships returning from the volcanic islands of the Aegean.
Oh, wow. So they literally shipped the rocks in.
Basically, yeah. When the captains unloaded the ballast, they repurposed it. But the real genius is in the mechanics of the installation. Artisans don't just lay these pebbles flat like modern bathroom tiles.
How do they do it?
They dig a trench, lay a thick bed of lime mortar, and insert the pebbles vertically, edge up.
Sideways? That sounds like it would take 5 times as long to cover the same surface area.
It does. Which is exactly why it was a status symbol. It proved a captain had the massive liquid capital required to pay a team of artisans to painstakingly place stones vertically for months.
That is such a flex.
It really is. But mechanically, setting them edge up gives the floor incredible structural durability against wear and tear.
That makes sense.
And more importantly, the porous nature of the stones and the lime mortar acts as a thermodynamic air conditioner.
Wait, an air conditioner?
Yes. During the brutal peak of a Rhodian summer, locals would splash water onto the courtyard floor. The vertical stones absorb and retain the moisture, slowly releasing it throughout the day to drastically cool the microclimate of the courtyard.
That is brilliant. So the floor itself is a thermodynamic cooling system financed by Mediterranean shipping routes.
Exactly.
And because the stones are set vertically, the ground is inherently uneven. It demands that you wear sturdy shoes, and it forces a specific, slower cadence to your walking.
You cannot physically sprint through Lindos.
No. The architecture demands that you engage with the terrain at the exact same pace a 17th century merchant would have. You are forced to feel the wealth of the village beneath your feet.
Which naturally leads us to the source of that wealth. Standing in those shaded, claustrophobic alleys, shielded from the wind and the sun, there is zero visible agriculture.
None.
There's no large-scale industry. To understand how a village essentially clinging to a barren rock generated enough capital to afford intricate mosaic cooling systems, You have to look outward to the water.
Here's where it gets really interesting. If you trace the shadow of the Acropolis down to the waterline, you find St. Paul's Bay.
It's a gorgeous spot.
It's this almost perfectly circular cove. The geology looks as though the limestone cliffs simply opened up a pair of rocky arms to physically embrace a pocket of the Aegean Sea.
Yeah.
And it carries a massive historical footprint, widely cited as the exact location where the Apostle Paul landed in 51 AD to preach Christianity to the island.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the Apostle Paul's arrival wasn't a random geographic anomaly. He arrived there because St. Paul's Bay is a masterclass in hydrodynamics and natural sheltering.
Right, because of the winds.
Exactly. The agent is notorious for the Meltami, the fierce, dry northern winds that blow relentlessly during the summer months. For deep draft, ancient trading vessels or Roman galleys, navigating those crosswinds was incredibly dangerous.
So the bay was a safe haven.
Completely. The rocky arms of St. Paul's Bay create a natural breakwater, entirely neutralizing the surface chop and the wind, providing a deep water, dead calm anchorage right at the base of the fortress.
Which means whoever controls that bay controls a vital pit stop on the maritime Silk Roads. Our sources highlight a fascinating point here about perspective, too.
Oh, about the approach.
Yeah. You can drive the modern 50-kilometer asphalt road from Rhodestown. You can walk through the labyrinth of the village, but you simply cannot comprehend the scale of Lindos from the land.
No, you can't.
Its psychological impact was designed to be consumed from the water.
Absolutely. The land approach is just a modern convenience. For the vast majority of human history, anyone interacting with Lindos, whether they were Roman traders, Byzantine diplomats, or Ottoman armadas, they all arrived by sea.
Right.
When you approach the eastern coast of Rhodes by boat, especially on an early morning departure, the visual intimidation is staggering.
Picture being a 14th century pirate or like an ancient sailor. You've been battling the unpredictable swells of the Mediterranean for weeks. You turn the headland seeking the shelter of the bay, and the first thing you see isn't a welcoming village.
Not at all.
You see a 116-meter sheer wall of impenetrable rock topped with the blazing white columns of a temple and the brutalist stone fortifications of the Knights Hospitaller catching the morning sun.
It's an incredible sight.
Looking up from the deck of a wooden ship, that verticality sends a very clear message. You are operating at our mercy.
It is the architecture of deterrence. The sea approach forces you to confront the reality that you cannot sneak up on Lindos, and you certainly cannot overpower it from below. You are fundamentally dwarfed by the combined power of natural geology and human military engineering.
But military engineering and sheltered bays don't solve the most basic biological problem.
Which is?
Thirst. You can have all the wealth and fortification in the world, but if you're living on a sun-baked rock on the edge of the sea, you can't drink the salt water.
Very true.
The sheer carrying capacity of Lindos, maintaining a permanent population and garrisoning troops during a siege, requires a massive logistical support system. We have to look away from the coast to find it.
You're referring to the island's interior hydrogeology.
Exactly.
And you are correct. The coastal fortress is really only the armored shell of the island. To find the lifeblood that sustains it, you must move inland to the island's softer hidden core.
Right. About halfway between the urban center of Rhodestown and the fortress of Lindos is a site called Eptipiges, or Seven Springs.
Such a beautiful contrast.
It is an absolute shock to the system. If Lindos is the heavily armored, sun-drenched vault holding the wealth of the coast, then Seven Springs is the quiet, biological engine pumping life support through the background.
It's a completely different environment.
You leave the glaring, whitewashed coast and drop into a dense, wooded valley of pine and plane trees. It's heavily shaded, the temperature drops noticeably, and fresh water flows continuously into a small lake.
The transition from the arid coast to the verdant interior really highlights the geological duality of Rhodes. The island's interior mountains act as a massive sponge.
A sponge.
Yeah. During the winter months, they capture the heavy Mediterranean rains. That water percolates down through the porous limestone layers over months, naturally filtering and eventually surfacing at pressure points like Eptipiges. It is a highly efficient natural reservoir system.
And historically, managing that water was just as vital as building walls. You can withstand a siege for months if you have grain, but if your freshwater supply is cut, your fortress falls in a matter of days.
It's game over.
Exactly. Eptipiges is a stark reminder that the ancient and medieval people of Rhodes weren't just skilled stonemasons. They were master hydraulic engineers who understood how to harness the island's internal ecosystem to project power on the coast.
Exactly. The springs provided the agricultural surplus and the vital hydration needed to sustain the coastal populations. When you pair a visit to the arid military heights of Lindos with the shaded water systems of the interior, you finally see the complete machine.
Everything working together.
You see the wealth, the defense, and the life support system all functioning as one unit.
So we've stripped down the mechanics of the space. We've looked at the vertical defense of the Acropolis, the thermodynamic engineering of the village mosaics, the hydrodynamics of the bay, and the hydrogeology of the inland springs.
We've covered a lot of ground.
We really have. But this entire system doesn't exist in a static state. The final variable we need to plug into this equation is time. specifically how the passage of a single 24-hour cycle drastically alters the physical and acoustic properties of Lindus.
Time is perhaps the most transformative element of the site. Because Lindus is highly accessible today, the summer months of June through August introduce a massive, high-energy, modern layer to the environment.
The tourists.
Thousands of day trippers flood the narrow alleys. The thermal mass of the village, the stone walls, the pebble floors, the limestone cliff, it absorbs the intense midday heat. And the acoustic environment becomes a chaotic wall of sound, bouncing off the tight corridors.
But the earth rotates, the sun begins to drop behind the interior mountains of the island, and the thermal and social dynamics completely flip. What actually happens to that machine when the day trippers retreat to their buses?
It is a radical atmospheric decompression.
Wow, decompression.
Yeah, as the late afternoon shifts toward sunset, the massive limestone acropolis begins to release the heat it trapped all day. The harsh, blinding glare of the aging sun softens into deep, long-cast shadows of blue and gold.
That sounds beautiful.
It is. But the most profound change is acoustic. Without the sheer volume of bodies in the narrow lanes, the soundscape reverts. The labyrinth of the village stops echoing modern chatter and starts channeling the sound of the wind coming off St. Paul's Bay.
So what does this all mean? Why is understanding that shift so critical to actually comprehending the sources we've been analyzing?
Because that twilight shift strips away the modern layer of tourism. It gives the village back its historical silence.
The historical silence?
Yes. When you walk those uneven, grooved cobblestones at sunset, with the temperature dropping and the crowds gone, you are experiencing the baseline reality of Lindus.
You can actually feel what it used to be.
You feel the isolation and the resilience that define the lives of the medieval knights standing watch on the walls and the sea captains calculating their next trade route in the courtyards. Making a late afternoon visit isn't about capturing better lighting for a photograph. It is the only way to genuinely interface with the ancient operating system of the settlement.
Reclaiming the historical silence. I think that perfectly crystallizes what we've been trying to uncover today.
It's the core of it all.
It really is. If you find yourself driving down that eastern coast, remember that Lindus is not a passive museum exhibit. It is a staggering feat of human survival.
Absolutely.
When you dip your hand in the sheltered waters of St. Paul's Bay, when you stare at the 14th century Byzantine frescoes, when you carefully navigate the thermodynamic pebble mosaics, and when you endure that grueling climb up a 30-story cliff to stand beneath a 4th century BC temple, you are physically interfacing with thousands of years of strategic brilliance.
This raises an important question, though.
Oh, what's that?
We have dissected the layers left by the Greeks, the Crusaders, and the maritime captains. They modified the rock to ensure their own survival, leaving behind temples, walls, and mosaics.
Right, they all left their mark.
As you walk through those lanes, adding the microscopic friction of your own footsteps to centuries of wear on the stones, what do you think the next layer of history added to Lindus will look like?
What?
When the structures of our era become the ancient foundations for whoever builds next, what story will we have left behind on the cliff?
That is an incredible thought to leave on, realizing that we are just the current inhabitants of the top layer.
Exactly.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the engineering, the economics, and the sheer willpower of Lindus. Keep questioning the ground you walk on, look for the mechanisms beneath the beauty, and we'll see you next time. Because no matter how deeply you analyze the surface, there is always a more complex machine operating underneath.